once again, and welcome to another episode of Musings on Golf, where today you'll hear from two-time U.S. Open champion Andy North. We'll recap an emotional victory for the Scot, Bob McIntyre, north of the border. We'll look at Yuka Saso winning her second U.S. Women's Open since 2021, and we'll see who is qualified for next week's U.S. Open at Pinehurst. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with my co-host and great friend Bob Bupka. You know, Robert, it was a true family affair for Bob McIntyre and his dad, Doogie, at the RBC Canadian Open. And it's been a heck of a family affair for you the past few days on Long Island, hasn't it?
Thanks for mentioning that, Kelly. You know, we had a celebration that tops all celebrations. I think it was my brother turning 80 years old, my brother Tom, my only brother, and one sister, Nancy. We all got together to put on this party. And his wife, June, it was incredible. The amount of friends that showed up, and every one of them had something great to say about my brother. I've known for a long time what a great brother he's been, Kelly. But to hear other people talk about him in those glowing terms, it really was a very, very special day in the Bupka family. And I appreciate you mentioning that, Kel.
Well, I'm so happy for the Bupka family. I know how important a family has been to you throughout your life, how close you are to your family members, and for you and Janice to be able to spend some time there. And you're not done. You're going to be up there in Long Island for what, another few days, another week or so, right?
Yeah, I'm saying to the weekend, you know, we got some more festivities planned. You know, when you come this far from Texas, where Janice and I live, you know, you got to take advantage of it. My sister, Nancy, down from Boston, so she's staying. It's just a great feeling to be with family.
Or Bob McIntyre, Bob, it's no doubt he'd been kind of honest here. He'd been homesick, you know, playing on the PGA Tour, being away from his home in Scotland. He needed a new caddy. I think he had let go of his caddy, reached out to his dad, Doogie. What an interesting guy. Number one is he's head groundskeeper at Glen Critton Golf Club in Oban, Scotland, really taught Bob the game. And how cool, Bob Bupka, for him to have his dad on the bag when he wins his first PGA Tour event, not just really as his coach and his mentor. It was far more Bob than just having him as his caddy. He was his right-hand man the entire time.
Yeah, he certainly was. And you know, when you step back and take a look at what transpired, it's absolutely incredible. McIntyre being from Scotland and then being in contention, calls his dad, and his dad jumps on a plane to come and caddy for him, and he gets to take that winning flag. His dad, Bob McIntyre, from all accounts, is an outstanding young man. You know, you grow up in Scotland, you have a different appreciation for the sport of golf. And Bob McIntyre, Kelly, exemplifies every one of those attributes. He's just a tremendous guy, a great winner on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, I'm really happy for him. No question about it. And Bob, look, we saw the emotion from the PGA Championship and the drama down at the end. This is what golf needs at the elite level. We need these storylines, right? We need to have a situation with Xander Schauffele, you know, having to make that birdie putt on 18 at Valhalla to win his first major championship, to have a father-son dynamic at RBC Canadian. This is the stuff, Bob, golf needs, not the talk about LIV and the PGA Tour and money, money, money. I love it.
Yeah, I don't blame you, Kelly. Anybody that loves this sport as much as you do, and it's certainly understandable. I mean, your dad, Max Elbin, the outstanding professional, I think 50 years at Burning Tree as the head professional. Boy, if you don't like golf, Kelly, you'd have been kicked out of the family.
I don't think there's any question about that. Let's hear what Bob McIntyre had to say about the value, the importance of having his dad literally by his side in winning his first PGA Tour event.
He taught me the game of golf, and then this week when I phoned him to come and caddy for me, to be honest, I was just coming here to play a golf tournament. There was no expectation to win it with him in the bag. It's just To be honest, I still can't believe that it happened. It changes everything. I mean, this is my fifth event in a row as well. I was planning to do US Open qualifier tomorrow. 36 holes with my dad in the bag. Thankfully, that's off the cards. And you know what? It's a dream come true, and I just can't believe it's happened. But it just shows that I can compete at the top level. I always knew I could, but until you do it, you really don't know.
So, Bob, while McIntyre was winning in Canada, Lancaster Country Club, I think, for the U.S. Women's Open really shined. Yuka Saso won, as I mentioned, for the second time. She won her first U.S. Women's Open in 2021, and she was obviously just the best player in the field. But you had a lot of good players, Bob, just who missed the cut. I mean, Nelly Korda shot 80 in the opening round, 10 over par 80, made a 10 on what obviously was a ridiculously hard 12th hole there, the 161-yard downhill par 3. Lexi Thompson, who announced her retirement earlier in the week, which I highly question. Nonetheless, she missed the cut as well. But clearly a stout challenge for the women at Lancaster Country Club.
Yes, it was. And, you know, I want to give a salute to Lexi Thompson. I've had numerous occasions with her. She's an outstanding young lady. Very, very talented golfer. And who knows what she has in mind for her future. I mean, that's her choice to make. Yes, people can argue, like yourself, that the timing may not have been the best in conjunction with the Women's Open. But that was Lexi's choice to make. And, and I respect and honor that choice because she is a very, very special young lady.
So, Bob, as we record this on Tuesday, June 4th, yesterday, and there's no question that it should be called golf's longest day. It's the final qualifying events for the U.S. Open, 10 events spread out over the United States and Canada, 36 holes. Hey, Bob, a total of 687 amateurs and professionals vying for 44 spots. A lot of really interesting stories. A guy named Ashton McCullough, who is a Canadian amateur champion, rising senior at Michigan State University. He was the only non-PGA Tour player among the 18 who qualified at the event in Ontario, just outside of where they had played the Canadian Open. So kudos to him. But then on the flip side, it looks like Adam Scott, who lost in a playoff, is not going to be able to get in. And the USGA has set aside some six spots based on world ranking and so forth. But Adam Scott's played in every major championship, Bob, since the 2001 Open Championship. It's the longest major streak. He might not be playing this year.
And it'd be tragic. I'm hoping the USGA will grant Adam Scott one of those exemptions. He has been a perfect gentleman, a perfect ambassador for this sport. And, you know, as good a golfer as he is, Kelly, he's even a better human being. And boy, that says a lot for a man of his stature, just as congenial as congenial could be. And I hope that he gets in. He certainly, matter of fact, if he gets in, believe it or not, he could win it. I mean, that's how good he really is.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. He's not, the door is not totally closed. I would certainly love to see it. Hey, Bob, I can't argue with you on that Adam Scott, think it's going a little bit. Why not? Now, hey, I thought it was a really sweet story. So Adam Scott played at Springfield Country Club in Ohio and not too far down the road. A guy named Justin Lauer, who's played some on the PGA Tour, but he's played a lot of Korn Ferry Tour events and knows the Scarlet course at Ohio State really well. He was either the medalist or co-medalist there. And his father passed away at age when Justin was 15. And he was just saying, he was very emotional when they interviewed him afterward, Bob. He's just saying, number one, to be able to play in the U.S. Open. And for him, if he were able to make the cut, to use his word, how cool it would be to be able to play on Father's Day and to be able to think about his dad. So talk about a heartwarming story, a guy you want to root for just to make the cut at Pinehurst number two for Justin Lauer. That would be a really neat story.
It really would. And, you know, there's so many stories within golf, about fathers that have taught their children to play golf, mothers yeah. that have taught their children to play golf. It's just one of those unique sports. You know, very rarely will you hear somebody say, well, I taught my son to play baseball. I taught my son to play football. You know, normally coaches get that role. But golf, a lot of times, more often than not, probably, it's the parents that introduce the youngster to the game. They fall in love with it. They become very good, and they're all wonderful ambassadors for the sport of golf.
We mentioned Bob McIntyre earlier. He, I think his celebration extended beyond what even he might have anticipated, and he is not going to be playing this week at the Memorial Tournament, at Jack's Tournament, one of the signature events on the PGA Tour, but always, you know, an elite field. Even if it wasn't classified as a signature event, best players play at Jack's Course. Mirfield Village stands on its own. Bob, you have a particular story about the Memorial Tournament, about Jack's, about being there, or just something maybe that strikes you as kind of a story that you'd like to talk about this week?
Well, you know, when I think of Jack's Tournament, there's an element to Jack's Tournament that doesn't prevail, I should say, at any other tournament, and that's the casitas. And, you know, at certain times of the year, they make so much noise. And I was sent out to do an interview, and I interviewed this player. I didn't realize it. I took it back into my boss, and he said, what the heck is this? I didn't want an interview of the casitas. I wanted an interview of the players. I mean, it's so loud, Kelly. You have to experience it in person to truly appreciate the natural phenomenon that takes place every so often. It's not every year, but more often than not, they'll come at least for one day.
And for those of you who may not know the Bubka-isms, we are talking about cicadas, not casitas. But for the purpose of this, what the heck? Let's go with casitas. I love it.
Sorry. Hey, my hearing is bad from all the noise they made.
All the noise they made. Hey, before we get to Andy North, I had the pleasure, Bob. I ended up, how about this? I played 73 holes of golf in just over 2 days at the fabulous Stream Song Resort in South Central Florida. Bob, Stream Song is one of these places. This is not a plug necessarily, but it's one of these places you have to experience as opposed to me telling you about it. I can tell you, you've got three incredible courses. You got the Black Course designed by Gil Hanson, Jim Wagner. You got the Red Course designed by Bill Coore and Ben Crenshaw, and the Blue Course designed by Tom Doak. You also have the Chain, which is a 19-hole. It's not a par three course by any means. It's a fabulous design by Coore Crenshaw, very much a walking course. They also have what they call the Gauntlet, which is a just over an acre of a putting course. Bob, this is an extraordinary place. I mean, this is kind of, frankly, in the middle of nowhere in, as I said, South Central Florida. It's got a lot of write-ups. The size of the putting greens, the putting surfaces, 11 acres, for example, the putting surfaces alone on the Black Course. It's apparently the largest collection, square footage-wise, acreage-wise, of any putting surfaces in the country on one golf course. So much sand, but it's worth it, man. I got to be honest with you. I saw a few women there, but it's frankly, it's a guy's trip. It's a bucket list. I would highly encourage those to go and play it. It's golf. Some have said it's kind of golf on the moon. There's some truth to that, I suppose. I'm so glad I went. My buddy Sean Walker, who set it up for our group of eight, man, it was so much fun. And I think we might just do it again next year, Bob.
Well, from everybody I've talked to, it automatically goes on the bucket list. If you live in the United States and you love golf, there's two things you have to do. One is play Stream Song. It is an ultimate experience in golf. Number two, you got to take a trip to Scotland. Anybody that takes a trip to Scotland that loves golf in the least comes away with just an experience that they'll never, ever forget. And I guess we're going to have to get a hold of Rhett Butler and get you a new pair of William and Harry golf shoes playing that much golf that quickly. Luckily, you had those comfortable shoes on.
I did, and I need those. I need the new pair of those Viper shoes for next week when I'm up at the U.S. Open. So, but speaking of U.S. Open, real quick before we head to some spots from our partners, Bob, Andy North. Yeah, he won the U.S. Open twice. I think people know him, frankly, a lot more through his. Gosh, it's been more than 30 years on the course reporting and now in studio for ABC and then for ESPN. Andy knows his stuff, obviously, very passionate about his home state of Wisconsin. He certainly found the magic, Bob, as a great putter and understood how to win major golf championships, two U.S. Opens. He only won three times on tour, two of them majors.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible, incredible story. And Andy North, for those that have get to know him, just a real, real nice guy. I mean, you probably could talk to him for a couple of hours and not even realize that, you know, a two-time U.S. Open champion. Just think about that, Kelly. Winning the U.S. Open once, absolutely incredible. Winning it twice, good golly, Miss Molly.
And you'll hear our interview with two-time U.S. Open champion Andy North right after these messages from our partners at Musings on Golf. Just like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry, and you should too. Folks, I love these golf shoes. They're made of deer skin and calf skin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William & Harry.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Celebrating its 30th year, the South Florida PGA Golf Pass offers the ultimate summer golf experience with special access to more than 100 private, semi-private, and public golf facilities. From May 1st through October 31st, Golf Pass members can enjoy special low rates, exclusive member-only outings, special offers, and more. For just $60, you can purchase the South Florida PGA Golf Pass and instantly gain access to all these great benefits through the member-only app. It's simple. Pay, download, play. Visit sfpgagolf.com/golfpass for more information. That's sfpgagolf.com/golfpass. Bob, we are just over a week away from the first shots being struck at the 124th U.S. Open at Pinehurst No. 2 in the Sand Hills of North Carolina. And we're thrilled to be joined today by a man who has raised the U.S. Open trophy twice in triumph and who will once again be on site at Pinehurst as ESPN's lead golf analyst. He's the pride of Thorpe, Wisconsin. And Bob, I dare you to find a more avid follower of University of Wisconsin sports than our guest, Andy North. Thanks for joining us and welcome to Musings on Golf.
Okay, Bob, I appreciate it. Yeah, it's been fun to been able to do all these years and gotten really involved with UW, and it's been fun to be around these young people that give you a lot of energy and, you know, get you excited about doing stuff.
When I hear the name Andy North, I can't help but think back to June of 1986, and you came to Shinnecock as the defending champion and spent some time out there, and I got to spend some time with you, and I walked away saying, wow, I knew he was a great golfer. I never had any idea that he was that nice a guy. That was
I fooled one person, Bob.
You're pretty good at that, but that was special times. And, you know, That was a very special U.S. Open at Shinnecock. I only grew up about 10 miles from there, so I never thought in my wildest dreams that they would hold a national championship there. But since then, it certainly has been highly regarded as one of the great U.S. Open courses in the country.
Yeah, 86, if I remember correctly, the weather was horrible the first couple of days. It was cold and rainy and miserable. Raymond took care of the business that week. He played exceptionally well. And, you know, for a guy who spent a lot of his life out on Long Island, I know that meant an awful lot to him.
It certainly did. It meant a lot to a lot of people that love golf because they got exposed to a thorough examination. I mean, you know, if you can play Shinnecock, you can play anywhere.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Particularly under the conditions that we seem to play there all the time, where the wind's blowing, it can get pretty nasty. But it's a hard golf course, and we're going back there pretty soon again. So that'll be fun.
2026, we'll be back there. Let's talk about the U.S. Open at Pinehurst, Mr. North. What should our listeners expect to see from the setup of the number two course next week? You know, I'm wondering if you were playing this version of Pinehurst number two in your prime, how would you approach it?
Well, I think, very simply, you pick an area in the middle of the green, and that's where you try to hit it. No matter where the hole location is, if you can put it in the dead center of every green at Pinehurst, you'll have a great week. So I think that's the strategy you have to play. I think you got to be really careful. When you've got holes cut in the back portion of the greens, you can't go long. You can't short side yourself there because the chipping and pitching is so difficult. So I think dead center of the green is where I'd try to play and not even care where the hole was. I honestly think you could probably play better at Pinehurst if they didn't even put flag sticks in the green. So they had a hole cut someplace. You didn't know where it was. You just played to the middle of the green. I think you'd probably do better.
Hey, Andy, is it true that you discovered golf as a kid essentially because of a bone disease in your left knee?
Yeah, I was a seventh grader playing every sport you could play. And I was having some trouble with my knee and went there, and I had a disease called osteochondritis dissecans, where it's an area of the bone in my knee was not getting blood supply, so it was starting to deteriorate. And really didn't have a great idea what to do with it. If they operated and cut that area out, I was never going to play sports again. So we decided to try non-weight bearing for 2 years. And I took a list of sports into the doctor because as far as I was concerned, my life was over. And he decided to let me play golf if I rode a cart and use your crutches to get around. And that's how I got started. And thank heavens that it's been a great journey because of that. The worst thing that could have ever happened to me turned out to be something very positive.
Well, we're so pleased to be joined by two-time U.S. Open champion Andy North of ESPN here on Musings on Golf. Hey, Andy, before I ask you about your time at UF, can you take that a little bit further in regards to when you started playing golf? You're tall. You're, 6'4". Were you tall as a kid? And was that a challenge to develop as a good player being tall as a kid?
I think basically the biggest issue back in those days when I was starting is that to get clubs to fit you the right length or the right stiffness or whatever, weight became a real problem because you didn't have the composite heads where you could control the weight. You had a wooden head. You can only take so much weight out of that before it shatters when you hit it. So the biggest thing is that I grew up playing clubs that were really heavy. And I'm just now 60 years later trying to figure out how to play something a little bit lighter. I don't think X2s at 74 years old is really a terrific idea. So I've tried some newer stuff that the shafts are about 25 grams lighter per shaft. It's such a different feel that I'm struggling to try to figure that out.
I mentioned University of Florida. I know how proud you are of your affiliation with the University of Wisconsin and living in Madison. But in fact, you were a three-time All-American at UF. You're in the Athletic Hall of Fame as a Gator great. Well, why the University of Florida, first of all, and then what were those years like for you at Gainesville?
Well, I think the biggest, I was fortunate. I was getting recruited by a lot of people. So you had an opportunity to really look at schools closely and figure out what would be best for you. Florida had probably the best business school of any of the schools that I was looking at for golf. So, that had a lot to do with it. Buster Bishop was the coach then. I really liked him. And that it made sense. I needed to get someplace warm if I wanted to become a better player. I actually had some offers to play basketball, so that was in the mix a little bit. But I thought Florida really fit what I wanted. It was a terrific program, a lot of great players, great history. But I really did think the business school there was a major part of it.
Professionally, you won three times on the PGA Tour, two of them obviously being the U.S. Open. Let's go to the first one, 78 at Cherry Hills outside of Denver. Doing the research on this, and you know this for a fact, you only needed 114 putts over the 72 holes, and that tied Billy Casper's record that he had set in 66 at Olympic Club. Okay, for those set of greens and for your skill that week, why were you so incredibly effective putting that week? What kind of putter did you also use? I remember you with a very thin putter, correct?
Yeah, I used a Cash In all those years that was a really great putter on super fast greens, which obviously the U.S. Open usually is that. I think one of the reasons it was a fairly low, I actually hit the ball quite well that week. But I think one of the issues that week to get to a low number of putts is that the greens were really, really firm. Cherry Hills is at an altitude, is 5,200 feet. By 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, there's no moisture in the golf course at all. By the afternoon, the greens are rock hard. I know that throughout the course of the week, I didn't even try to carry the ball anywhere near where I was trying to land the ball 1 yard on the front of every green, basically, is that was what I was trying to do. And because of that, you hit a lot of really good shots that are a foot off the green or 2 feet off the green. They're maybe putting the ball from off the green. So I think that's one of the reasons the putting numbers were quite low. It wasn't a week that I holed them from everywhere.
Well,
so I think it was more a fact that you had a lot of putts from the fringes, that type of thing.
Yeah. And by the way, before I ask you about Oakland Hills in 85, I'm wondering, what's the feeling like? What is it like down the stretch of the U.S. Open trying to win that championship for the first time? What was going through your mind? Were you nervous? Were you pumped? Were you scared? What were you?
I mean, I've told this story quite a few times. I really played exceptionally well the first 67 holes of the golf tournament. I hit the ball really, really well. Did pretty much what I wanted to do. I had a putt at the 13th hole. It was a back left hole location. I had about 15 or 18 feet to the right of the hole. And I believe I was up three at the time over Stockton. And lining up the putt, you talk to your caddy all the time about, dumb stuff. But, it was one of those deals that we're seeing, let's knock this thing in. If I can make this is over. And I got ahead of myself. I ended up making the putt, got four ahead. And from that point on, it was like that little fine line, that little extra that it's almost like they unplugged my electricity. And from that point on, I had nothing. I literally had nothing. I didn't hit very many good shots the rest of the way in. And I was happy we didn't have any more holes to play because I'd have been in trouble.
So then I mentioned Oakland Hills in 85. I lived in the Detroit area for about 7 years and played the South Course. Just a big, brawny layout. You only had nine birdies the entire four rounds. You hit the four fairways in the final round. That championship obviously is, as much remembered for TC Chen's double hit as anything. You trailed him by a couple shots going to the final round. What was the difference on Sunday for you at Oakland Hills?
Well, I mean, interesting. Again, that week I played beautiful golf the first 54 holes. I think I was number one in greens hit, maybe number one in fairway. I mean, I really played terrific golf all week long and got up Sunday morning. And we'd played all day in the rain on Saturday. And I got up Sunday morning, and I mean, I couldn't hit the broadside of a barn, which is not a good feeling when you're in the last group of the U.S. Open, when you really don't have anything. And I really struggled. The first 12 holes, I really hit a lot of poor shots. TC Chin really did us all a favor. He was two ahead. And when we got to the fifth hole, he was four ahead. He'd made a birdie. I'd made a bogey. And, he tried a shot that you probably shouldn't try at that hole, and it led to an eight. And he really let everybody else back in the golf turn. I mean, the tournament was his, and he was playing unbelievably well. And I got the lead, and I bogeyed 9, 10, and 11. And he maybe got the lead back, or Dennis Watson or somebody, one of the other guys there. But I really didn't lay the club on it. And then I drove in the fairway bunker at the 12th hole, the 5-par. And I hit a good shot out of the fairway bunker of the 5-iron lane and then hit a nice third shot. And it was all of a sudden, things sort of clicked in. Those two swings were swings that felt really good. And from that point on, I hit it pretty solid the rest of the way in. The finishing holes there are not easy. 14's brutally tough. I hit a really good shot into 13 and made a putt for a birdie to get the lead back. And then just tried to figure out a way to make pars coming in. And, I made enough of them.
What a special time we're having right now with two-time U.S. Open champion Andy North of ESPN right here on Musings on Golf. Andy, let me ask you this question. There's been an argument as long as I've been involved in golf. Some people think that if you're shorter, it's an advantage to play. Others say, no, if you're taller, it's an advantage to play. What are your personal thoughts on whether it's easier to be taller or shorter?
Well, I think the one thing that's beautiful about this game is that there's a million different ways to play it. If y'all had to do it the same way, it probably would be very difficult to become any good at it. But I think that, historically, if you are shorter, it made it easier to get equipment. That's starting to change. You're seeing more big guys get involved in the game because you can actually get equipment that fits. You can get 45 or 46 inch drivers for when we started, most of the guys played 43 because the clubs were so heavy. But all in all, there's a lot of different ways to do this, Bob. I don't think there's one. You look at our greatest players over history of time, most of them have been under 6 foot tall. But there's a lot more really good players. The Dustin Johnsons and the Phil Mickelsons and some of the taller guys now, I think, because of equipment, that's really opened up the opportunity for a lot of different size people to play the game.
Did I hear that an injury to Gary Koch, who's going to be with us on Musings on Golf in the very near future, actually served an opportunity for you to get in golf because of his injury?
Gary worked for ESPN back then. He fell at the Canadian Open and broke his ankle walking on the golf course. So the next week was Quad Cities. They were looking for somebody to fill in. I had done a couple of things with ESPN before that, and I decided, what the heck, may as well do it. And it was an awful lot of fun, and I think they at least thought I had some kind of potential. And that was kind of the start. The next year, I started working with them full-time, and it's been 32 years since. So, yeah, it's worked out okay for a guy who has no idea what television's all about.
Andy, what's a typical week like for you in covering a major golf championship? And I'm talking about in terms of when you arrive, your sure. preparation on site, and the number of reports that you will actually do.
Yeah, I generally will get to a major championship on the weekend before, usually Sunday. I really enjoy walking the golf course as much as I can before a lot of the players get there, where you get a really good feel for how the golf course is playing, what are going to be the key shots that you have to look for, trying to come up with some stories that, the viewer might enjoy about a hole or whatever. And then Monday, I'll walk the golf course usually Monday and Tuesday again. Usually try to do it following some players during practice rounds to see how they're trying to approach the golf course. You know, talk to as many people as you possibly can early in the week, and then we start doing. Yeah, we'll do Sports Center hits starting Monday. We'll do, usually there'll be multiple Sports Center hits throughout the week. And if we're actually doing the event, then you've got, like the PGA, where we had Thursday and Friday, you're basically on air for 12 hours a day and, you know, just trying to tell the folks at home what's going on and give them a little insight of what's happening in the golf tournament.
Well, we're winding down our time with Andy North here on Musings on Golf. Hey, Andy, I've got three questions. You mentioned about the PGA Championship, 21 under par, won it. Highly, highly unusual. In your opinion, did that detract at all, that low score detract at all from what a major championship, I suppose, should be?
No, I don't think so. I think the beauty of the major championships, they're all a little bit different. Augusta National, the Masters, you play the same golf course every year. People at home recognize holes. They recognize shots. They remember Tiger's chip in at 16. They remember Jack's 4-iron to 15, you know, whatever age group you're in and what you take from that tournament. Then the PGA has always been more of a kind of a regular tournament, regular tour type event, maybe not set up quite as hard. This year, they had an unusual situation where they had absolutely no wind, the weather was warm, and they had a ton of rain. So the golf course is going to be soft, and you put the best players in the world on a soft golf course with no wind, they're going to kill it. So it doesn't matter what you do. I thought they had some unbelievable – I thought Kerry Haig did a great job setting it up. I thought they had some really, really tough hole locations, but with it being soft, it really didn't make any difference. So that then you've got the U.S. Open, which I think is historically has probably been the most difficult. You're playing on a golf course that has some history, but not the same kind of history you have at the Masters where you're playing the same golf. But you might remember back to a shot that somebody hit at Pinehurst, you know, in 14 or in 6 or in 99, Payne Stewart's putt in 99, whatever. But it's a different setup than the first two. And then I think then you go to the Open Championship and you're playing a totally different kind of golf. So I think it's the golf majors are very much like the tennis majors. You're playing different surfaces, different conditions. The majors are really there to test the player to see who is the best player. And I think overall they do that quite well.
To change course a little bit, I know you're heavily involved at the University of Wisconsin Carbone Cancer Center. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the cancer scare that you had as a player and the numerous charitable donations that you continue to help raise in your beloved home state to try to eradicate this terrible disease.
Yeah, my connection with the Carbone Cancer Center started about 35 years ago when my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. She spent quite a bit of time there, surgeries, the chemo, the radiation, the whole deal afterwards. And she did great. I mean, she just recently passed away at 97. So she did really well after that. And her doctor was Paul Carbone at the time. So his name is now on the Cancer Center. He was the first director. Terrific guy. I got involved. I've been on the cancer board basically since then. And about 15 years ago, Susan and I decided, you know, we do all these things for so many other people. Why don't we find something that we really want to do? So we decided we wanted to raise money for the Cancer Center. She lost a parent. I've lost parents with cancer. I've had prostate. I've had multiple skin cancers with, you know, major operation kind of stuff. So, you know, we've been touched as everybody has been. So we decided we'd start this. And in 2009, you're in the middle of a financial crisis. The gentleman who was our fundraiser for the Cancer Center, his wife found out she had cancer literally 3 months before we were going to do our first event. And we decided, you know, we're going to do this event. If it's small, people are going to have a great time. It's going to be, you know, a great experience. And luckily, the very first year, Tom Watson and Aaron Rodgers came to it. And the three of us had a lot of fun. It was fairly small. And We got rained out early in the day. We sat around and told stories for 2 or 3 hours, and that might have been the best thing that ever happened. It got this thing kicked off. Then we ended up playing a little bit of golf later that day. But all in all, we've really enjoyed it. We've raised very, very close to $20 million over the last 15 years. And all of it goes, every bit of it goes to research. And those dollars, for every dollar that we can raise, turns into $12 to $15 as it goes through the pipeline with grants from NIH and other sources. So basically, we're using our money for like seed money that you're investing in a researcher that they need 50 grand or 100 grand to get the numbers to put together to go ahead and go out and get a $1 million grant or a $5 million grant. So we've been really happy how it's gone, and it's called the Andy Northrup Friends. And because it's friends, you know, it's people that have been friends for years that have gotten on board, and it's been really terrific.
Is there a website for that?
I think you can go on Andy Northrup Friends. You can go on the Carbone Cancer Center, either one of those, and you can probably get where you're going to go. But all in all, we've had a blast doing it. We've had some great experiences that we've been able to put people into, and we've had an awful lot of great friends that have supported it at no cost to us, which is, you know, that's the only way you can raise enough money to do something. So it's been really, it's been an awesome run.
Right. And by the way, for our listeners, Carbone is spelled C-A-R-B-O-N-E. Andy, final question for me, and it's one that I ask, or we ask all of our guests, and it's really been interesting to get the range of answers and emotions, quite honestly. And that is, who would round out a dream foursome of you played with? Three other people, whether living or deceased, who would they be? And where would you play that magical round, if you will?
Oh, gosh. You know, that you could come up with a million scenarios for this, and I'm sure you've heard that before.
We have.
I think ideally, I played a ton of golf with my dad growing up. We spent so much time, you know, 6 to 9 o'clock at night running around that last 9 holes, you know, after work, after school, you know, never made my mother very happy that we never showed up for any meals until it got dark, kind of deal. I'd love to be able to play some golf with him again, obviously. My two heroes growing up were Jack and Arnold, as a lot of people might. You know, to get a chance to play with them and my father, I've gotten to play a little bit of golf with my granddaughter over the last couple of years. She's getting a little bit excited about playing golf. But I think that if, you know, Jack Arnold and my dad would be a pretty good way to go. You know, when you're playing with great friends and great buddies, it doesn't matter where you play. You know, you can go play some goat track someplace, or you go play the best course in the world. If I had my perfect, he'd probably go to Cypress Point. I think that's, if I had one round of golf to play, I'd probably go there.
Why?
I think it's a combination of a lot of the things that I really do like about golf. It's a wonderful golf course. It's always in great condition. It's at a beautiful location. The walk around there through the sand dunes and down on the beach and on the ocean and, you know, the famous 16th hole there, you know, they're 15, 16 are two unbelievable holes right along the ocean. 17 is one that caused a lot of problems over the years. But I think it's a wonderful walk. It's always in great condition, and there's nobody there. Yeah, that's the best part. You go there on a middle of summer day, there might be four foursomes. You might not see another player. To me, that is what makes golf so neat, that you just play it at your own speed. It's a beautiful walk through nature, and you've got to hit some pretty good shots because it's a golf course.
I'll let you close it out with Mr. North, please.
Yeah, I want to thank Andy, and I'm going to ask him his pick for the 2024 U.S. Open at Pinehurst. But I want to share a story. First off, I want to say that winning 2 U.S. Opens is an absolutely incredible accomplishment. I believe what you're doing for cancer, Andy, may even exceed winning 2 U.S. Opens, and congratulations on all your efforts. You know, I mentioned 86 when you came to Shinnecock. You know, that year the Masters won by Jack. They say it's the greatest Masters ever. I waited on Thursday afternoon for Jack to finish. I had never spoken to him. He didn't have a particularly good day. There weren't as many media members as there, you know, are now. And so I wanted to get Jack's opinion of the U.S. Open coming to Shinnecock. So I waited my turn, Andy, and I said, Mr. Nicholas, you have a minute? He says, sure, what do you need? I said, I'm actually here to get your thoughts on the U.S. Open coming to Shinnecock. And Jack said, Shinnecock, I'm here to win the Masters. You want to talk about Shinnecock? I said, thank you, Mr. Nicholas. I turned and went. So that was Jack. But who, if you had to pick one to win at Pinehurst, who's it going to be, Andy North?
Well, I know this is probably a pretty simple ask, but the best ball striker in golf right now is Scottie Scheffler. He's obviously played amazing golf over the last 18 months. I think iron play is going to be so important at Pinehurst, and he's the best there is in the game. I can't imagine picking anybody but him.
Well, I'm going to Las Vegas tonight.
You're not getting a great odds.
That's the problem, right? Yeah.
He's probably going to be 3-1 is all. Yeah, right.
Well, exactly. He's a champion, and so are you, Andy North. And thank you so much for taking time out of a busy schedule to join us here on Musings on Golf. We deeply appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Bob. And yeah, we've been friends a long time. I really appreciate it. You guys are doing a great job.
Just like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry, and you should too. Folks, I love these golf shoes. They're made of deerskin and calfskin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William & Harry. Yeah, Bob, as you said, I'm so impressed with Andy North, the person. He's been, really, he's been part of the golf scene for, almost 50 years now. We do know him for what he does on the air. But, man, what he did putting at Cherry Hills when he won his first U.S. Open, boy, does that guy know how to make clutch putts in major events.
Well, he's a clutch guy. I mean, no surprise that he knows how to make clutch putts. He's just exceptional. A good old Wisconsin boy in Madison, Wisconsin, I believe is his hometown. And
oh yeah,
boy, they don't grow him any finer than being grown up in Wisconsin.
Well, we thank Andy North very much for being with us. Hey, Bob, by the way, I mentioned about William & Harry. I'm going to be with my brother next week at the U.S. Open at Pinehurst, number 2. And our buddy Rhett Butler, I know, is going to be sending me a pair of those, the new Viper shoes that I will be donning, much like Janice paraded around at Insperity with her golf shoes. Hey, look, we encourage everybody, go to williamandharry.com. And when you place your order there, put in the discount code 10OFF, M-O-G. That's the number 10, the word off, and then M-O-G, which, Bob, stands for Musings on Golf. Again, we thank Andy North very much. And, Bob, next week, as we count down the final days to the U.S. Open, Gary Koch will be joining us as he returns to covering the U.S. Open for NBC Sports. I know Gary's anxious to be back in the booth and be sitting next to Steve Sands. And Bob, really looking forward to hearing from Gary. Great guy.
Oh, one of the best out there. And his talent broadcasting probably only exceeded by his talent to play this lovely game of golf. Look forward to our chat with Gary Koch.
With a family man on Long Island, Robert Bubka, I'm Kelly Elbin signing off on Musings on Golf.